The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this Tuesday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up in just a moment, more than midway through 2021, we'll recap Georgia and its efforts to vaccinate more folks. Plus, we'll meet an Atlanta-based couple and hear their concept for affordable and sustainable housing. Here's a hint: shipping containers. Those conversations and more on today's program in just a moment. But first, this, the weather. Tropical Depression Danny appears to be weakening. That's according to the National Hurricane Center. Now, Danny came in late Monday near the Georgia-South Carolina border. Heavy rains are expected to continue across Georgia and South Carolina into tonight. And you know, Georgia, some scattered rain showers and a few thunderstorms might pop up this evening. That could mostly occur in areas of North and West Georgia today. In other news, state lawmakers heard from the public Monday evening during the first of an in-person public hearings regarding redrawing the state's election districts. The General Assembly must redraw the districts every 10 years to balance population changes. For several hours, and I do mean several, lawmakers heard from citizens on the subject. Mark Bogard, who identified as a longtime resident of Gwinnett County, told the committee he'd like to see parts of other counties grouped with Gwinnett.
The bottom line is I would just love to see y'all maybe take some of, you know, Walton County or, you know, more of Newnan, something where we kind of get a bigger slice of the pie. I mean, I realize Gwinnett County is pretty big, but as it is, we sort of feel as if, at least I do, I feel very disenfranchised, you know, by the fact that I've got severed off the rest of Gwinnett County. I was 7th District at one time, so.
Ayanna Dennis told the committee she would like the committee to be more transparent and include plenty of options for input.
And we also need language access and ASL interpretation. No Georgian should be left out of this process. There also needs to be multiple in-person and virtual hearings across the state that actually fits in with days and time frames that most Georgians can come and testify. I am a working mother. I have to go pick my daughter up from daycare. Other people do not have the privilege that I have to be standing here today. That's not fair.
Now, lawmakers are holding nearly a dozen other meetings all over state this summer, and you can find out more on our website where those public hearings will be taking place. Finally, a win tonight for the Atlanta Hawks evens their NBA Eastern Conference Championship Series with the Milwaukee Bucks. However, that win may depend on the foot of point guard Trae Young, who has a bruised bone. A loss in tonight's game at State Farm Arena could be the last time the home crowd gets to cheer for the Hawks this season, although some teams have come back from being down 3-1. We shall see. Believe. I believe that's what everyone is saying. Believe. This is Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. And as always, I'm Rose Scott. Last week, Governor Brian Kemp issued the final executive order extending the public health state of emergency, which will now expire this Thursday, July 1st at 12 a.m. Now, we should note the governor could issue new guidelines as it relates to the COVID-19 pandemic. In fact, according to Kemp's office, this week a new executive order could include the suspension of various state rules and regulations. Meanwhile, the nation won't reach President Joe Biden's 70% of American adults with at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine by July 4th. Right now, according to the State Department of Public Health, about 38% of the population in this state is considered fully vaccinated. There's a lot of related news to get to, so back again with the latest on COVID-19 in Georgia. Our WABE health reporter and host of the podcast, Did You Wash Your Hands, Sam Whitehead. Sam, welcome back.
Hey, Rose. Good to be with you, as always.
Wow. We're more than midway through 2021, Sam. So if you want to recap Georgia's vaccination rollout, let's start with the successes. How did Georgia do?
I mean, I think it's important to look at where the numbers are now, right? So checking the latest figures from the State Department of Public Health, about 43% of Georgians have received at least one dose of the vaccine. They've gotten the process started. Compare that 43% to 54% nationally. If we want to think about people who are fully vaccinated, so that's they've completed a full vaccine regimen, either the two-dose regimens or the one-dose regimen, 38% of Georgians have done that compared with 46% nationally. So looking at where we are as we approach July 4th and this goal, really, that the Biden administration set to have 70% of all adults with at least one shot, you know, Georgia's lagging the nation and Georgia's lagging a bunch of other states, really. You know, we've seen certain parts of the country, I'm thinking of states in the Northeast, whose vaccination rates for both one shot and fully vaccinated are just very far ahead of Georgia's. And if we want to think about kind of the pace over the course of the pandemic, Georgia's kind of trailed many other states over the course of the vaccine rollout. So it's not a real surprise to kind of see where we are now.
So and if we're talking about challenges, are we still focusing on rural and some other specific communities that are still lagging behind in getting vaccinated here?
I mean, I think yes and yes. But I think what's important to keep in mind is that at this point, we've really moved away from the days of the big mass vaccination site where, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people will drive or walk in each day to get a shot. The real effort has moved, you know, it's gotten a lot smaller. It's gotten a lot more targeted. And kind of what's happened along with that is we've seen kind of less of a big push from the state of Georgia, like a big centralized push. You know, we've seen local health departments do things like mobile buses where they go to churches or community centers. We've also seen some nonprofits move into that space. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just at a vaccination site last week at MARTA's Laredo Bus Garage where they were trying to get employees vaccinated. And, you know, from conversations that I've had with federal health officials, you know, specifically the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, you know, she says it's important to, you know, think of each additional shot in each additional arm as a win. We're not going to see the kind of large volumes of vaccines administered from this point forward. But, you know, each person who gets vaccinated is one more little brick in this protection wall that we're building.
And we should note, I believe, Fulton and DeKalb County are still pushing for folks to get vaccinated. Just the other day, there's a new South Fulton vaccination site that's going to open actually today, as a matter of fact. So those counties, I believe Fulton and DeKalb have always been in that top five of the counties in the state in terms of not only just COVID cases, but also in leading, sadly, in some areas of hospitalizations and deaths.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, though, I've even seen that DeKalb is also shifting their focus, going more towards smaller, more targeted vaccination sites. They got some CARES Act money. This is the big coronavirus relief package passed by Congress earlier this year to support a mobile vaccination unit. So certainly while health departments are still, you know, offering shots to people who can come to them, I think there's also an understanding that there is still a lot of work to be done to reach people where they are.
And Sam, I know it may be difficult to get this data, but what do we know about the 12 to 16-year-olds, since most of those, that population will probably go to their pediatricians or their parents. They have, obviously, a family physician. Do we have much data on that number?
So that's a great question. The State Department of Public Health, which has been publishing vaccination data for a while now, does break it down by different age groups, but they don't actually go down as low as 12 years of age. So the smallest kind of age breakdown they have is 15 to 19-year-olds, and we do see from their data that we do see fewer people in that age group who have been vaccinated. Now, looking at federal data from the CDC, they do actually list, you know, the percentage of the total U.S. population over the age of 12 that has gotten vaccinated. And they say, you know, 63% of everyone over 12, so that's inclusive of that 12 to 15 age group, but then it's everyone else has gotten a shot. So, you know, I think this is indicative of something we've seen over the course of the pandemic. It's that it's gathering this data and getting down to this kind of granular level of analysis is a job in and of itself. And I think it's important to keep in mind that public health agencies are under-resourced and their focus right now is, you know, getting shots in arms, not necessarily. And I think that's come at the expense, as we've seen over the course of the pandemic, of having really good data.
And speaking of really good data, and we need to be fair because the Department of Health came under fire initially with their COVID dashboard, which some had questioned, but it's still updated regularly, correct?
It is. It's actually been a minute since I've checked the dashboard myself because cases are so low right now. But it is still being updated regularly. And, you know, I'm really curious to see the way that assets like these are maintained as we move into the future. You know, pre-pandemic, if you wanted to get an update from the Department of Public Health on, say, flu season, they would put out a weekly report. A lot of that data was stuff that came directly from the CDC with a few state numbers. But it was no way, shape, or form the kind of lift that maintaining a interactive dashboard is. And that's something they've been doing for the pandemic. And so, you know, I'm curious to see the point at which the State Department of Public Health changes how they present this data. Because I can't imagine at some point in time we will see a significant change to how they share this.
And again, we know that early on, before there was a vaccine, obviously getting those regular updates about testing. Is testing still a priority now in this state?
You know, I would say it's hard to say whether or not it's a priority. I have talked recently with folks at the Department of Public Health, and they tell me that testing numbers are just down generally. You know, I think we're at a point in this pandemic, Rose, where, you know, for people who are fully vaccinated, they're probably not thinking about testing anymore. You know, I did do a quick check of the Department of Public Health's website. All of their offices they have in counties all over the state are still offering testing. You know, you can still get tested at private pharmacies and hospitals and things like that. So, you know, it's not like this is a resource that's gone away. But what I would imagine has happened is that the public focus on testing, the kind of high demand that we saw, especially last summer, for testing has certainly fallen.
Well, and obviously with the focus on vaccines. Well, and speaking of vaccines, let's talk about what the Department of Public Health and what you know in terms of what they're communicating about this now, the Delta variant, which, you know, we've heard Dr. Fauci say now, this will be the dominant virus here in this nation. What is the Georgia Department of Health saying about all this?
Yeah, so I reached out to them last week just to get an update on where we were in the state with the Delta variant. And the first thing they pointed out was something we were just speaking about. Testing is down significantly, is what they tell me. And so if you consider that they're getting fewer test results and only a small percentage of those are sequenced, tested to see which kind of variant we're dealing with. They say our numbers are likely undercounted when we think about how many cases linked to the Delta variant we have here in the state. Last week, that number was fewer than 30, right? Fewer than 30 in the state, but DPH acknowledges that's an undercount.
Yeah.
What I think is interesting is when I reached out to ask about the Delta variant, they informed me of where we were with the Alpha variant. So this was the one first found widely circulating in the UK. And people might remember earlier on in the year, this was not the most widely circulating variant in the country or in the state. But as of last week, the Alpha variant accounted for almost 80% of Georgia cases. So in the span of just a few months, we had the, you know, wild type, we can call it, you know, the OG coronavirus.
Look at Sam Whitehead using the OG. You've been hanging out with me too much, Sam.
That had been replaced by the Alpha variant. And so, you know, public health officials at the federal level have really warned that it really is potentially only a matter of time before we see that same kind of explosion of the Delta variant here.
If you just joined us, I'm joined by Sam Whitehead. He is our WABE health reporter and, of course, host of the podcast, Did You Wash Your Hands? Sam, that being what you just said, then one might say, well, then shouldn't the Department of Health really push for folks to get tested and to also possibly get the vaccine because of what we're hearing with this Delta variant?
I think should is a weighty word. Right. You know, for me, I think about a few things. There are messengers that, you know, polling has shown people trust about vaccination more than others. You know, great polling from the folks at the Kaiser Family Foundation has found that generally the public doesn't want to hear politicians tell them to do something about their health. You know, people who are maybe on the fence, they're in, you know, the group who wants to wait and see what happens before they get vaccinated. This polling has shown that it's beneficial for them to have conversations with their healthcare providers.
Okay. Now, for those that have a healthcare provider.
Sure, exactly, which is a big, important caveat. Now, that polling has also shown that, you know, public health agencies like the CDC are also trusted messengers. And, you know, I know the Department of Public Health at the state level, and I know that, you know, local public health agencies, even some local governments. For example, the county commission in Gwinnett County is funding a vaccine confidence campaign. So, you know, there are efforts at the state and local level, even though we haven't seen things in Georgia like we maybe saw in other states, you know, the Vax-a-Million campaign in Ohio, for example. You know, we haven't seen a push like that here.
So you're saying we need a lottery where get a vaccine and get an entry for $1 million?
There, I've even seen some early reporting recently questioning the effectiveness of those campaigns. Truly, that you know, it's, and I think the verdict is out on you know, things like that get a lot of publicity.
Yeah,
and I think the verdict is out on really whether or not they move the needle. For someone who is, you know, very firmly resistant to getting vaccinated, you know, those are hard barriers to overcome.
Yeah. Well, they've tried everything from free tacos to free tequila shots, which I'm not sure you want a tequila shot after getting vaccinated, but hey, do you. But let's talk about this Delta variant, Sam, and I know you're not a doctor, you don't play one on television, but what are you hearing about this Delta variant and the symptoms? Are they more severe?
Well, the verdict is still out on that, too. I mean, I think it's still important. It's important to remember with all of these new variants that it does take time for, you know, the, you know, good research to be done. What the CDC says about this variant at this point is that it does appear to be more transmissible, which we've seen with other variants to the kind of wild type coronavirus. And it's important to know that increased transmissibility does mean the potential for more cases, and you get more cases, you get more severe disease, you get potentially more deaths. There has been some early reporting from the New York Times about this variant causing potentially different kinds of symptoms. There were some small studies in China that pointed to that. And the CDC does say that even though the vaccines that we have are widely protective against the different variants, that there does appear to be some potential for reduced effectiveness against the Delta variant with the vaccines available here in the U.S.
Which is Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, and Moderna for right now. Let's switch, because as it relates to what might Governor Kemp's anticipated modified or into the public health state of emergency set to expire this Thursday at 12 a.m. What are his options here, Sam?
Well, I think it's important to remember what this public health state of emergency did. It kind of sent this signal like, hey, this is an emergency. And I think that signaling is very important. But it also did a bunch of things that helped, you know, for instance, the healthcare sector respond to the pandemic. It made it easier for certain people to give vaccines. It lowered the bar for, you know, certain regulations on where healthcare facilities could open or even who could practice here in the state. And so it is yet to be seen which of those kinds of provisions the governor is going to carry forward. We do expect an additional executive order from his office later this week. And I wouldn't be surprised to see some of those provisions included, because, you know, we still have hospitals who I think are probably concerned about seeing flare-ups in cases. Mm-hmm. You know, the governor said a few weeks ago the state is already having conversations. His office is already having conversations about, you know, how to deal with schools going back later this year, workplaces returning potentially in person later on this year. So, you know, I think there even is an awareness from the governor's office that we're not potentially out of the woods here totally, even mm-hmm. though it seems unlikely we'll see as big a spike as we did early this year.
So we shall wait and see what happens on July 1st. Finally, Sam, some podcast news regarding did you wash your hands? You know I had to bring that in there.
Yeah, so thank you. So after we've, I think, been releasing two episodes a week for probably about a year now, and that was actually down from five, I think, at the start of the pandemic. But next week, because we are going to pass this big milestone set out by President Biden, mm-hmm. As of this week, this will be our last week where we do two episodes. Two releases a week. Starting next week, we're going to go to Thursdays. That doesn't mean we're going away. There's certainly lots more stories we can tell about COVID and any other mm-hmm. kinds of health issues here in the state. But, you know, the pace of news is changing. And I think that we're just trying to keep listeners informed while understanding that this is maybe not the top issue for everyone the way it was a year ago.
Speaking of listeners, I just have an email from a listener who wants to know, ask Sam who determines when the pandemic is no longer a pandemic? I think I know the answer to that. Is it the World Health Organization?
I think it is the World Health Organization. That's a great question. They have been the ones over the course of this whole situation who have, you know, kind of classified this, mm-hmm. right? So yeah, that's where I'll be looking to get the signal that it is not officially a pandemic anymore.
Well, even before we came on air, you heard in the NPR newscast the issues they're having now in Russia. Obviously, we know about the continent of Africa and trying mm-hmm. to get just these nations getting them access to the vaccine. So it could be a year, it could be years before they officially declare the coronavirus pandemic over.
I mean, I've had conversations with folks where if we want to think about this as an outbreak that's still causing trouble in parts of the world, talk about 2023.
And will you change, did you wash your hands to, are you still washing your hands?
I'm just glad that is the public health message that everyone has stuck with. It's been consistent over the course of the pandemic. We, you know, other recommendations have come and gone, but washing your hands is still tried and true.
I remember the controversy over what should we call this podcast?
I don't know if it was a controversy.
Well, I think I was causing a controversy. I was like, I don't know if I like that. Also, congratulations on being nominated for a Georgia Association of Broadcasters Award, Sam.
Thank you, Rose.
WAB health reporter and host of the podcast that Rose Scott did not initially like the title of, Did You Wash Your Hands? I can admit that I was wrong, I guess, Sam.
I mean, I've gotten that from listeners, too, who have suggested we change it.
But it didn't grab me at first, you know?
Well, when all the branding has been set, that's a lot of work. People worked yeah. really hard on our logo and stuff. We're not going to change that.
Our chief content officer, Scott, will enjoy me saying that, telling everyone that, hey, I ain't like the name of that podcast. Sam, thanks so much. I appreciate it as always.
Thanks, Rose.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Here's how the National Association of City Transportation Officials define what our next segment is all about. Parklets are public seating platforms that convert curbside parking spaces into vibrant community spaces. That's it. And the concept was even talked about in a 2018 TEDx talk from Reno, Nevada. It was from a small business owner named Nellie Davis.
Parklets are just a two parking space change that a community can make to revitalize the entire streetscape and take ownership of an area. Not only have they proven to increase foot traffic and encourage social interaction, but they put life back into concrete. And it's the absence of this type of vibrancy that allows blight to set in.
Life back into concrete. Joining me now from the City of Atlanta is Tim Keene, Commissioner of Planning and Community Development, and Vanessa Lira, Assistant Director in the Office of Design. Welcome to the program, both of you. I really appreciate it. Listen, I gave a brief definition of parklets. Commissioner Keene, I'll start with you. Can you give a more detailed design description of a parklet?
Well, the introduction you provided was excellent.
That's simple, huh?
It's what we're doing here in Atlanta. The one thing I'd say, though, Rose, is that, and it's important to focus on the very specific changes that happen on the street when mm-hmm. when you create a space like this. But I want to make one broader comment, which is the work that we're doing with small business owners in Atlanta to use parking spaces for seating and for people to sit, and whether they're eating or not, is really just, it's part of what we must do in Atlanta. You know, like our big challenge as a city is to make walking and riding bikes and use of transit mm-hmm. more pleasant for people in the city, because we've designed a city so far almost entirely based on driving, and we have to shift completely to a city that is designed for walking and cycling and getting to transit. And this is, it's details like this that really matter. This is the difference between success and failure when it comes to this, making places like this in the city.
All right. Well, let me bring in Vanessa Lear, Assistant Director in the Office of Design, because I'm curious, when we talk about these parklets, can the designs vary? I've seen some drawings where they're real nice. They have nice tables and benches, and that might even be covered, and there's some, you know, plants along the way. So the design can vary. Is that, am I explaining that correctly?
Yeah, that's correct. The design can certainly vary, and the price point can certainly vary as well. And so you've seen probably in places like San Francisco where they've spent a lot of time creating very unique ones that are specific to that location, that have different seating types. And so our focus here was to get as many on the ground as we could as fast as possible because of the pandemic. And so the approach was slightly different, but they're certainly in a more permanent condition. You can get as creative as you'd like.
Well, let me ask you all this, and either one of you can tackle this first. Is there a specific type of street infrastructure-wise that these parklets may work best if where they're located? I mean, what's an idea street? I'm imagining, are we talking about a one-way street? And also, you all know parking in the city of Atlanta. And so when folks hear you, what, you're going to take parking spaces? So for our listeners who, you know, are maybe giving y'all a little side eye right now because of that, what is the idea street infrastructure-wise for a parklet?
You want to speak to that, Vanessa?
Sure. Yeah. Obviously, the first thing that needs to happen is there needs to be an existing parking space there in order for it to be converted. So that's our first layer of eligibility. But really, we found that they work best when it's in a location that has a little bit of foot traffic already, mm-hmm. whether it's because there's a restaurant there or there, it could be all sorts of different reasons why someone would want to stop at that particular location. So there being a reason for someone to want to rest at that spot is really helpful for it to be vibrant and successful. And we've also found that if you pair it with a community organization or with a business that's adjacent to it, that's going to be taking care of it, that also really helps. And as far as the infrastructure, really, it's just making sure that the parking space is there and that it's in an area where people are going to be walking by it.
Are they mobile? Can they be moved with ease?
There certainly are ones that can be moved with ease. The ones that we have right now, which are temporary version, they can be moved easily. The barriers are water filled. So once you drain the water, they're really light. Once you fill it up with water, it can't be moved as easily. And so that's certainly something, if it doesn't work in a particular location, we can always try it out in a different place. And that we have done that in the past.
And where are some of these parklets located right now within the city of Atlanta?
We have them in a lot of different neighborhoods: Home Park, Sweet Auburn, Kirkwood, Cascade Heights, Summerhill, Midtown, Virginia Highland, Downtown, Cabbage Town, really all over. There's one in Grant Park. We have them in several different locations.
Commissioner King, you mentioned that these parklets should be viewed to be beneficial in terms of transit and mobility enhancements. But here's a question, too, in terms of the cost for this. Would the city pay for these parklets, or if a business wanted one or a business district wanted some parklets, who picks up the tab for this? And how much are we talking about per parklet?
Well, this particular program is one that that we are paying for. We generate revenue through an agreement with MARTA that we generate through advertisements that are on the bus shelters in the city. So we have a way of funding this particular program that is from a very specific piece of revenue that we generate in partnership with MARTA. And the total that we've invested so far in this, in all of these locations, the total amount is $100,000. We're going to invest more, though. The locations that we have out there now are, as Vanessa said, wanted to get them out there quickly, so they're fairly simple. But we will invest more in these so that they become more intricate and thoughtfully designed. So there'll be more investment in them. But the partnership with MARTA and the revenue that we're investing in this is, we think, very appropriate. Because as I said, if you're going to expect a vibrant street, which is needed in order for more people to walk and ride their bike and use transit for transportation, then this is what helps with that. You know, it is these kinds of investments that make a street a place people want to be. And so it seems like a very small amount to invest in this big issue we have around transportation in Atlanta.
Given with folks wanting obviously more bike lanes, obviously we have folks on scooters, we have the bus, obviously MARTA operating. And Commissioner King, you and I have had this conversation before about Atlanta streets and the infrastructure. How do you respond, and either you or Director Lyra can answer this, how do you respond to someone who says, how can you ensure that there won't be, one, some overcrowdedness or just plain clutter, and will you also have bike racks available? Because if you want to increase more foot traffic or folks riding their bikes and they want to stop at a parklet, will there be a bike rack or something similar? Would each parklet be designed to maybe house one or two bikes as well? And then also, what about for folks with disabilities here?
Yeah, I can touch on those things. And so speaking to the bikes, that's definitely feedback that we've gotten from both from the survey that we have out as well as from business owners. And so that's something that we are looking into for the future. When it comes to accessibility, the temporary version, we have a ramp that gets you down to road level. But one of the upgrades that we're going to be bringing in this summer is a deck that's going to make the parklet flush with the sidewalk. So there will not be an accessibility issue. It will be at the same level. That was something that just takes a little bit longer because they are made to order. And so that wasn't something that we were able to provide within a couple of months, but that's what we're working on for an upgrade for the summer. And then your third question about the maintenance, that's something that we've learned. It really is important to partner with a business or an organization that's going to be there day to day maintaining and making sure that it's being well utilized. And that's been very successful when we have done it that way.
So in a sense, this is a trial run for parklets. And how would you all evaluate the success, the effectiveness of it? Will you wait to hear feedback from the community, from business owners? How will you assess this?
Well, we have both a survey out, like I mentioned, that is out on the parklet. So if you're using the parklet, you can answer the survey. We've also been speaking with business owners. And this is the second round of parklets that we're doing. We did do a different parklet a few years ago, so we have already learned significantly from that. And we are, you know, thinking through what type of upgrades we might want to do based on that feedback that we've received. And I think it's also a trial run in terms of not just the success of the parklet in terms of how people want them, but just also in terms of if this is good for our streets, which we really believe that it is. And so we're working with HLDOT, which is a transportation department, very closely on that. With our team that works with the local businesses as well. So there's a team of people that's really making sure that these are going to be successful and hopefully be able to be on the ground beyond the pandemic. That's a feedback that we've heard over and over again, is that people want these to be more permanent and they want them to be long lasting beyond just this emergency situation that we have currently.
And the great thing about Atlanta is that we don't necessarily go through all four seasons. But as we wrap up, will these parklets be able to withstand, Georgia can have some, Atlanta can have some great weather, and we can have some not so nice weather?
Yes, they will be able to definitely withstand the weather. We've had similar situations, both with the parklet that we've done in Grant Park that was before this round, as well as with the boardwalk that we have downtown that are on the ground year round. There are certain cities that do have to remove them during winter, but we don't believe that that will be the case with our weather conditions.
And I have an email from a listener who wants to know, will these parklets, they won't disturb the bus booths and in the bus stops where folks can sit down, will it?
No, that is one of the eligibility requirements. It has to be 100 feet away from a bus stop, so we'll certainly not preclude that.
Commissioner Tim Keene, I'll give you the last word. You are always talking about how to improve Atlanta's transit and mobility enhancement. As we wrap up and say goodbye, you see parklets being very instrumental in that.
I think it's an important element of many elements that we have to employ in Atlanta. To your earlier point, Rose, about the city becoming more congested, we all live in a very fast-growing region, and we have a fast-growing city. And we all need to get into the mindset of congestion is going to need to be part of our lives, and how do we enhance the street life of the city as we grow and become more congested, and this is part of that.
All right. Tim Keene, Commissioner of Planning and Community Development, and Vanessa Lira, Assistant Director in the Office of Design. Thank you both for taking time. I really appreciate it. Good information about parklets.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. If you're following Atlanta's average medium home price, it's been fluctuating between $395,000, hold on to your hair, $405,000. Now, according to Redfin, in May of this year, Atlanta home prices were up 24.6% compared to last year, selling for a medium price of, yes, $405,000. If you got it, I'm happy for you. On average, homes in Atlanta sell after 19 days on the market compared to 41 days last year. There were 1,792 homes sold in May this year. That was up from 1,030 last year, which ponders this question, where's the affordable housing? And depending on whom you ask and where they live, you'll get a lot of different answers. And I know, because you all, the listener, you've heard a lot of different answers. And from over the years, we've spoken to so many folks about housing affordability.
What's happening in the city, many of the communities that have really stuck through the hard times, and now the redevelopment's coming, people are getting pushed out, and they are not there to reap the benefits when they've lived in a food desert or when their schools have been failing. Those people deserve to reap in the benefits of what the city is becoming.
It really is a ticking time bomb for our region, and many people have turned away from it because it's not an easy answer.
We've lost about 5,000 affordable housing units in Atlanta over the past couple years. So rents are getting higher.
I'm concerned about what neighborhoods and what the city looks like 20 years from now. Do we have a beltline that is just for the affluent? Do we have a city that's just for the affluent?
I think one of my initial evaluations is that we may have lost sight of people a little bit.
There's 10,000 seniors that enter the market every day, but there's not 10,000 units being built for them to live in. This is a crisis stage right now. We're not approaching a crisis stage. We're already in it.
I would assume I am the target demographic. I am a young millennial. I really just don't know who the people are that are affording these places.
If you look up on the horizon, the change that's coming is a tsunami. And if we don't match that shifting the way that we see the world, we know we're not going to be able to live here.
Wow, that clip is nearly 4 years old when we started talking about affordable housing. Yes, and so much of it still applies, right? But there is consensus about one aspect of affordable housing. There's no one solution. Well, Elise and Majesty Gale are the founders of Evo Holdings, and they join me now to talk about their work in creating sustainable and affordable homes throughout Metro Atlanta. Elise and Majesty, welcome to the program. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
So, Elise, I was watching your expression when I told you that Clipper is nearly 4 years old. Everything that those folks talked about right here on this program still applies today. Your thoughts on defining affordable housing?
Well, like you said, that clip was from 4 years ago, and it's just startling to see what has happened since, I guess you could say, since the pandemic as far as housing affordability. And when we talk affordability, we also have to talk about availability as well, because the resources just aren't there at this time. And I don't believe they were there 4 years ago either. And so with everything that has happened, there's been an increasingly just large amount of need in that space. So it's a big problem. It's a global problem.
Matt, let me ask you this, because you all are in this space, you've worked in this area. How long will this demand, which is high and inventory so low, it continues to be a seller's market? How long might this trend continue? And how concerning is it for you?
This is a huge concern, because honestly, all numbers, all data leads to this continuing on for some time. And when I say some time, we're talking 5 to 10 years without some type of extreme action coming from, you know, the public side of things. So it's very concerning. If, like you said, that clip is from 4 years ago, and we've been doing this for a while as far as the affordable housing space, and it's only gotten more, I'd say, exclusive. Mm-hmm. So I just see, you know, housing becoming a true luxury as opposed to a right.
So let me, and I can stay with you, Majesty, and then Elise, you can jump in there. So how long has is it Evo Group Holdings been around?
Yes. Well, we've been around, or we've been in real estate for about 8 years now total. We got into affordable housing very seriously with a focus on affordable housing about 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. So this was right, you know, before the pandemic. We were already advocating and kind of saying the same exact things that the clip was saying. After the pandemic hit, we just saw need skyrocket to the point that we realized there's not one organization in Atlanta or in any specific city that can deal with this magnitude of an issue. It has to come from public-private partnership. And that is when we established a nonprofit and started going that route.
And so, Elise, when we are at the intersection of housing as it relates to affordability and sustainability, and you all know, you've heard people say, well, sustainability costs more, but you're shaking your head, you're saying it doesn't necessarily have to when you talk about affordable housing, correct?
Well, that's an interesting point that you bring up, the intersection between sustainability and affordability, because you just definitely want to make sure that people are living in the best conditions possible, for, I guess, what one would consider the most economical pricing as well. But that's where it gets a little bit tricky, because when you think about anything that's sustainable or organic or good for you, it typically comes at a premium. So that's definitely something that we are working to change.
So in other words, it's like eating healthy. People say, well, eating healthy is more expensive. And you're like, really? That's a whole nother conversation. Elise, let me stay with you, because I want to talk about these shipping containers, because there's a concept here, right?
Yes, definitely. And I would actually defer that to Majesty, because he works a lot of, on the construction side. So I'll let him talk a little bit about
and
the
Majesty,
shipping container
yeah,
aspect.
I have folks emailing me saying they want shipping containers already. What's the concept here? How does it work?
I mean, it's pretty straightforward. I know people have kind of seen the concept, but we have a twist on ours. Specifically, we use containers, and these are certified containers, so they're certified safe by the DCA. But we also couple that with renewable energy systems as well. And we have plans to include other sustainable aspects as well in the near future. But right now, we're using the containers. They're similar to Legos. They can be customized in any way. Mm-hmm. We see apartment buildings going up with them, hospitals, schools, all that good stuff. So we're focused on the residential aspect, because that is where the need is. So that's what we do.
So I want to be clear, because these aren't necessarily in the mode of what we call part of the micro housing movement, or would they be?
We do have products that go all the way down to the tiny house spectrum. And it's important to consider that concept, because with the smaller size, the smaller footprints come lower cost. So we have a product that's all, that's under $100,000, you know, for housing, which is amazing. But we also have product as well that is larger. So we do have some that meets in that spectrum, but some that are in the traditional size.
Well, Elisa, and this actually came overnight from a listener. They wanted to know, what is an ideal household that fits this best model? Are we talking about, you know, single family, sort of a single family home? If you're one person, you know, who's the best household that this model would fit?
Well, we, like my Majesty said, we have a product for different ranges of income levels. And so especially when we talk about affordable housing, we would talk about our nonprofit arm, Push Nation. Mm-hmm. And that entity, it renovates housing for people that are looking for a little bit more space at a more economical cost.
And so for that arm, for your nonprofit arm, that is also where you all are developing this 17-lot sustainable solar power community in Atlanta. Is that correct? Or is that under Evo?
Yeah, that will be under Evo.
Yeah.
Y'all got a lot going on, which is
we're
great.
We're going to break it down for you. We need to break it down just a little bit.
Y'all got a whole lot going on. So let's let's back up. So yeah, the shipping containers, that is not part of the nonprofit arm, correct? Or is it?
That's correct. That would be more workforce housing, where we're looking to meet that 80% of AMI. And then the nonprofit is for those that are at the 30% and below, because they still need housing as well. So we have a dual partnership or dual entity structure working here to make sure that we service everyone and that everyone gets housing.
So you're meeting both.
Exactly.
Now, let me ask you this, because then I just have another question from a listener who wants to know, are the shipping, y'all got these shipping containers on people's brains, are they mobile?
Yeah, well, they can be. Now, the caveat there is that if it's not affixed to the ground, then it is not considered real estate, so you don't get the benefits of real estate, such as appreciation, depreciation, all that good stuff. When it's not affixed to a foundation, it's considered a trailer, mobile home, or more so a vehicle. Mm-hmm. So it depends on what's important to you. I would say affix it to the ground.
And personally, also, well, let me get this in there, because I'm wondering also, Majesty, does that also depend on the ordinances of what city you live in?
Yes.
Because some cities, exactly. They don't really
exactly.
dig that kind
yep.
of stuff.
You're exactly correct.
Let's talk about then the 17-lot sustainable solar power community in Atlanta. Where in the area are you all looking at?
This project will be in the city of South Fulton. We've already secured the site, already working on horizontal development, clearing, and all that good stuff. So it'll be in the city of South Fulton, which is just south of Atlanta.
When might this project be completed?
The project will be completed as of the end of next year. We will start on ground up our vertical construction October of this year.
And for the term solar-powered community, take that further for listeners who want to know what that means.
Well, each structure will have the option of having a complete solar panel array installed on the structure that can power the home. Mm-hmm. So they'll have their own, you know, I guess you could say grid somewhat. To work with, but they'll still be tied into the grid to get power just in case there's any issues with weather or, you know, what have you.
Is this model being used anywhere else in the nation? Because when we talk about solar, and I remember having conversations about this, and folks say, oh, solar, again, expensive. It's expensive for the homeowner. And you all are saying, no, this is going to be low cost. And given the community that you are building in and the folks you're trying to get into this house, someone says, okay, well, where's the bulk of this funding going to come from?
Well, we have actually launched an opportunity fund that covers the expenses of the project cost, and all of our structures, all of our projects can be financed via government programs. So, you know, we try to make it as inclusive as possible, and it's very important to build the solar in up front so that could be financed as opposed to paid out of pocket.
What about through HUD? What about finance?
Yeah, HUD.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yes, we worked with HUD, and that we actually got a grant from HUD as well to do some affordable housing development. So we work with them very closely.
I have an email from someone says, "Where do I apply?" But again, we're having fun with that. But obviously, it lends itself to what we started this conversation about, which is affordable housing. There is a need for that. We just got about 2 minutes, Elise. I wanted just for you to, if you can, why you all do this.
Well, we do it because we actually started our careers in real estate and acquisitions, and we quickly noticed that a lot of people were being displaced from their communities, and we wanted to provide a solution for, I guess, what you would call gentrification, just to be plain with you. And we've been able to do that through acquisitions and targeting certain zip codes like South Fulton, to provide sustainable and affordable options for people in those communities so that they can stay in those communities.
And again, if folks want to learn more about applying, I mean, I know there's a process here and a criteria for that solar power community in Atlanta. Where can they get more information?
Yes, they can go to evohaven.com. That's evohaven.com. And they can contact our broker partner at Keller Williams, Diamond B Realty.
And I have another listener. This will be the final question. They want to know, can the fireplace be in the shipping container? What are y'all thinking, people?
You can do anything with it. It's just like any other structure. But, you know, you can customize it. Yes.
I love my listeners. They're well informed. They have good questions. But the shipping container, for a moment, what's it made out of? What's the material there? Is it plastic?
It's made out of something called Corten steel. Mm-hmm. And it's actually also coated with something that is actually rust resistant. So a lot of people have misconceptions about the containers, but think about it. All of the most important things that we have in our lives are being shipped in them for a reason.
So no more cleaning the gutters is what you're saying with these shipping containers?
Oh, no. It, unfortunately, you still have to clean the gutters.
There'll be gutters.
Your lawn, still got to do the dishes. Too. We're working on some solutions for that so we can build that into there as well.
What is your end goal, whether it's with the shipping containers or with the affordable housing? In 5 years, where do you want to see these both concepts grow for you all?
Well, I can speak for us. When I think we would like to expand nationally, and we would like to be in at least 5 major markets, making an impact in you know, communities that are neglected.
Sounds good to me. Elise and Majesty Gale, founders of Evo Holdings, and they joined me today to talk about creating sustainable and affordable homes throughout Metro Atlanta. We'll have links on our page to their information. Thank you both so much for taking time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having
Thank you.
Me. Appreciate that.
And that's it for this edition of Closer Look. A reminder, you can always let us know what you think about the program. Just email me, rose@wabe.org. And remember, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m. as well as in our podcast. Subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now plugged in, a WABE Politics podcast. New name, same on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE Politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we talk to politicians and voters to break down each week's biggest headlines. New episodes drop on Fridays. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.
WABE.